Hello, I'm Claire Armitstead. Before you get started with this edition of the Books Podcast, we want to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For everything you need to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian to get 10% off your first purchase. And now, on with the show.
The Guardian.
Anything that has got a genuine personal vision behind it, I think that that is what is missing from an awful lot of culture.
This thing... Yeah. Well, that, we know you're at the Guardian talk when that's what gets us.
Hello and welcome indeed to the Guardian Books Podcast. This week we listen in to two masters of literary mind-bending and cultural mischief. Alan Moore has become a bit of a one-man cult with his comics classics including V for Vendetta and The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. In his world, comic books aren't limited to superheroes and derring-do. He believes they have a much more serious role as engines of the imagination.
Wouldn't it be great if you had, like, the four archangels? They were all playing snooker.
However, to the dismay of many, but the delight of many others, he has announced that he thinks he's done with comic books and is excited about the idea of exploring art forms that he isn't so comfortable with. In this instance, writing literary fiction.
You've moved into literary fiction as a failed pornographer.
Yeah, that's more or less what I'm saying. Right.
Jerusalem is his second novel so far, and he's clearly relished it. Weighing in at well over 600,000 words, it's longer than the Bible, and it chooses as its subject an unusual hero. A small British city, no less.
You've made Northampton into a myth, into a metaphor for the idea of an afterlife. Has there been any comeback from people there about that?
Yeah, the Northampton's where you go when you die.
But Moore is interested in the idea of what he calls psychogeography and how it evolves into psychobiography.
If you're going to talk about a place, inevitably you're going to be talking about the people that have passed through that place and have lived there. And if you're talking about people, you can't really talk about people unless you're going to talk about where they come from, the circumstances that I emerge from.
And we'll hear more than a glancing pass at wisdom.
Yeah, I think that actually just reading words about stuff can actually rewire you.
If you take one thing away from this Guardian Literary Podcast...
Reading words about stuff.
It's the sense there can be no broader encouragement for the notion of reading in its widest sense than just words about stuff.
Is worth it.
And so, with no further ado, let's hear some words about stuff. Never does to try to outdo a comedian, so here's Stuart Lee welcoming Alan Moore to the stage at the Guardian Live event.
You all know why you're here, but I have to do a... It's traditional at these things, you have to do a quick précis of the person's life so before you bring them on. So, born in 1953... From relatively humble beginnings, he got a place at Northampton Grammar School only to return from whence he came after being expelled for dealing LSD, something our guest tonight maintains he did not for profit, but out of loyalty to the teachings of Timothy Leary. Having spent some years dabbling in newspaper cartoons, he eventually became best known as a superhero and fantasy comics writer who revolutionised the mainstream medium in the 80s and then left it ruined for all future contributors. Since then, he's been a novelist, a performance artist, husband, father, grandfather, general polymath, would-be time-travelling wizard, and all this without leaving the security of his beloved Northampton, where his second novel, Jerusalem, which we're talking about tonight, is set. Please welcome Alan Moore. Alan's got a version of the book broken down into fragments, which is easier.
Yeah.
Give a shout out if who's read this.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Not. Yeah. Well, you'll need a lot of time. That's the thing. I've lived with it. I'm going to just read a little brief summary of it before we'll talk about it. Is that all right with
That's
you?
That's quite all right with me, Stuart, yeah.
Jerusalem, 10 years in the making. Mm-hmm. It opens with a prologue set in Northampton in which a man called Mick Warren, based on your brother, who's called...
Mick Moore. Yeah.
He describes some of the names he's changed, some of them he's left the same, of the people. He describes a vision he had to his sister, an artist, based on you, who's called Alma.
Yeah.
And then there are three books, each about 350 pages long. The first is a series of 11 vignettes describing the lives in the same few vividly realised square miles of working-class Northampton of various ancestors of Mick and Alma and other associate characters going back as far as the Crusades. And it gradually dawned on me that they were all interconnected and that many of the characters that I assumed were alive were actually ghosts superimposed over Northampton, visible only to each other and to drunks and madmen. And there's a chapter where an inexplicable but apparently significant game of billiards is happening in the back room of a pub. The second book, 350-odd pages later, begins with the infant Mick being rushed to hospital in 1959, having choked on a cough sweet and being technically dead. And then the book becomes a famous five-star sort of adventure of a gang of child ghosts who are looking after the technically dead boy in an afterlife apparently built from the dreams and memories of the people of Northampton. In a landscape that folds all the places from the first third of the book sort of into itself in a massive sort of piece of origami in which angelic figures are playing billiards to describe the future of humanity. And it ends, that book, with the ghost children racing across a surreal landscape on a woolly mammoth they have brought through a wormhole in time and which they feed on magic mushrooms made of human dreams to get Mick back to his earthly life at the point where the doctor revives him.
That's a fair assessment.
Fair assessment, yeah. Yeah. And the third book, 7 pages in now, ties up all the loose ends from book one and two, but then unravels new ones and features an amazing chapter in which the spirit of Mick and Alma's grandfather, Snowy Vernal, who's based on a real person, carries on his shoulders the spirits of his infant granddaughter as they journey through this weird landscape to the end of all human history as reality sort of dissolves around them because reality is a construct, as I understand it from this, from human consciousness. That's page 1009. All human history ends. The book, however, carries on beyond that.
You're putting it like this, and I hadn't actually thought of it. No. It does. Yeah, I see, put like that, it does sound a bit of a problem, doesn't it?
Yeah. It goes on the end of the book, 165 pages later, there's an exhibition in which Alma exhibits paintings that are based on her brother's memory of his near-death experience. And that is the structure of the book. But obviously a book is a lot more than the events in it, especially when it's written by Alan Moore. So I think we'll sort of work through it and see what pops up. You've been on it for 10 years, this book.
Yeah, I mean, that is... There were a couple of years off for good behaviour. After I'd finished the Lucia Joyce chapter, I realised that I actually couldn't put together English sentences anymore, that I'd just got this compulsion to... Any two words which occurred to me, I had to kind of ram them together to make a third one. And I thought,
that's the most difficult bit of the book. I mean, that's the bit... In Voice of the Fire, I said to you, why have you written... your first novel, I remember saying to you, why have you written the first chapter in an incomprehensible gobbledygook? And you said, to keep cunts out of my book.
Yeah,
The cruel thing about this is you let them hang in there for about 800 pages before you put them...
Yeah, before I spring that... Well, I learned the lesson with that first one. And although, yeah, that was my reaction at the time. I probably could have phrased that better.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I did definitely mean it. But I've since found out about the concept of literary difficulty, which is where you deliberately sacrifice a certain degree of your audience. You know that you're going to alienate a certain amount, but where the ones who remain will be forced to engage with the book upon a much deeper and more satisfying level. But yeah, basically to keep that cunt.
Well, yeah. Actually, it's funny you say, because I mean, it's like reading three different books. It's obviously your intention. They're split up into different bits. But the sort of methodical structure of the first book, where each chapter is about a different person's life in a different time in Northampton, means that when you get to the end of that, and then the second book is much more narrative-driven, it feels like you're travelling in hyperspace at enormous speed compared to the shifts in the level that information is drip-fed out change so rapidly. It's a very exciting experience.
Well, and some of that, it was mainly done intuitively. I wouldn't want to claim that I'd got a really clever plan.
Right.
But it occurred to me as I went along. I mean, the first two books are all in the past tense.
Right.
The third book is all in the present tense because I wanted, I don't know, some kind of greater immediacy to the third book, because that's probably the weirdest of the three books.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Yeah, but you're probably right that, I mean, sort of these things, they all kind of help to move it along.
I mean, the obvious comparison initially is the first book is with Ulysses by Joyce, where it's a modernist touchstone. It's a sort of cubist examination of one day in one city. Mm-hmm. This first book of Jerusalem is all different days from history happening in the same couple of square miles of Northampton, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it's that idea made more complicated, but also to take to a place that hasn't got any. Northampton's a blank canvas to most people, isn't it? It's an interesting place to choose.
It's true.
Yeah, it's not. What I mean is, it's not got a historical resonance, but it's something that you know really well living there.
If you want to write something about London, and I've written a few things about London, but there you've got an awful lot of competition. Ian Sinclair, Charles Dickens, all the other London writers, you know. Whereas Northampton, it's an open field, really, isn't it? You know, it's.
This is an A to Z of Northampton, which I recommend. If you get this, the copy I was sent of this book, now that I understand the official copy has a map in the front of Northampton, but the copy I did didn't have any, because it takes place in the same three or four streets. I found that I used this quite a lot to work out
the viability of the
places through overlaid over each other in time. I also found myself thinking about Hill of Dreams by Arthur Machen, which is another book. I mean, you probably recommended this to me years ago, but it's a book where London is overlaid over itself through time. He comes to London and he finds himself experiencing Roman life and Victorian life and all simultaneously.
Yeah. Machen is... he's a kind of an influence upon all sorts of things. But, yeah, I mean, certainly writing about place... I mean, his kind of wandering around Stoke Newington and sort of places like that. He was probably, before the term was coined, he was a psychogeographer.
Yeah.
I don't think there's much more to write about than place, ultimately. I know that, that's an extreme kind of statement, but... when I was doing the thing about Steve Moore, I did a thing called Unearthing that was set, it was mainly about my late friend Steve Moore, who lived the entirety of his life on top of Shooter's Hill. And I kind of thought, this is a piece of psychogeography, because it's talking about the history of the hill and everything like that. It's also a piece of psychobiography, because it's talking about this one individual who lived on that hill. And I kind of came to the conclusion you probably can't do one without the other. That if you're going to talk about a place, inevitably you're going to be talking about the people that have passed through that place and have lived there. And if you're talking about people, you can't really talk about people unless you're going to talk about where they come from. The circumstances that I emerge from.
But the extra layer for you in this is that most of the characters that you describe in detail, the lives of and the environments where they grew up in the first book, are relatives that you've discovered in your own research of your family tree, or people that would have been around Northampton then. So it's obviously got a very personal reason to you. It's got a very personal reason for doing it, which is that you've worked back through this family and found sort of precedents for your own behaviour, or...?
Yeah, well, it's... We in the writing of the book, I mean, I originally wrote the book because I'd started to hear enough stories about my family and the area that we grew up in to think, actually, this would make a really stunning book. But in the course of the book, I found out more about both of those things. Yet nearly everybody in the book is a real person. Nearly all of the events, even the unlikely ones, yeah, they're true. It's a kind of fictional glue. Yeah, I'm not going to sort of promise that all of the angels and demons mentioned in the book are actually known personally to me, but sort of, but by and large, it's
well,
it's
I did
true.
Start Googling things, because the names would come up that I would recognise as being real, or as people that I knew you knew. And then other ones, very unlikely characters, I found myself checking them. Black Charlie, an escaped slave who was branded and ended up in a 19th century Northampton, where he's a kind of junk collector riding around on a bike he'd made himself with wheels made out of rope.
Yeah.
And that was a real historical figure from the time.
Yeah, when I found out about Black Charlie, his name was Henry George, that was the first time I'd realised that slaves were branded. I'd never heard that. Perhaps everybody else knew it but me, but they were branded. And, I mean, as far as I could work out with his chronology, he hadn't escaped. He'd been liberated.
Yeah, and then
in 1865,
to work, yeah.
Where he would have been 13.
Yeah.
So at some point during the book, I had to think, what would be the best age to brand a child? You know, I mean, you wouldn't want to do it when they were too young because that might kill them. But you wouldn't want to let them get too old, would you? Because they might fight back or run away. What, about 10, 11, something like that? You find yourself having to think some very funny things when you're writing a book of this size and kind of scope.
Well, another thing that popped up out of it, that again, it seems really prescient now, it's that you seem to want to write an epic novel about the British working class as well. And there's a scene at the end of the first book, which I don't know may be true or not, but Mick, your brother, is watching Shameless on television, the Channel 4 sitcom, and gets kind of annoyed that the depictions of the working class are always in this sort of violent way. And he doesn't reflect his own experience of his own life.
That was me using my brother as a kind of ventriloquist dummy, right. Where I was... I'm not sure... I don't know whether he feels much about Shameless one way or the other. Yeah. But I was
well, he's going to get in trouble now, isn't he?
He probably is. But yeah, I just wanted to impose my own bigoted opinions of Shameless, right. But through him, if you like.
But again, it seems really prescient now, because the sort of fallout post-Brexit, whichever side of the debate people are on, you know, the working class are written about by liberal middle-class commentators, this kind of crazed mob whose desires have to be satiated no matter where they've come from. And it's a really good time for a book to turn up with 350 pages showing the rich variety of life that can inform people in society that isn't reduced to that stereotype. Well, and there's loads of bits. I mean, you keep talking about, you know, how they got on well with black servicemen in the 50s, and they're not... UKIP caricature, that people in that.
Yeah, no, they're not kind of, a xenophobic sort of caricature, like you say. That said, there is quite a lot of racism in the working class. That is true. It's not universal, and there is an awful lot of genuine egalitarian spirit in the working class. I would imagine that there's probably an equal distribution of racists through all of the social classes.
It's probably worth pointing out at this point that the magic mushrooms that the giant mammoth eats are wrapped up in an Oswald Mosley black shirt's flag.
That's true. Well, all of the rich pageant of human life is kind of included somewhere in the boroughs, and we did have Oswald Mosley, I think, coming down to preach because we'd got some... local influential black shirts, but I don't think that he made much of an impression upon the people in the boroughs.
Can I ask one last thing about the first book, because we've got two more to get through. You presumably had some kind of schematic, right, where you knew that in the second book, all these characters that you painstakingly set up were going to then be in this afterlife place that we'll come to. But the second book takes all the characters in the first book and whisks them all together. In the first bit, they're in these isolated environments. Yeah. There's no way, reading it, the first stuff, you have no... To come to the book clean and not have read any reviews of it, you can't have any sense where it's going. And it's so amazing when you get to the second book and see the landscapes all used again from the first book in a different way, the characters all used again in a different way. Was it difficult to hold off like that? Because it's a masterpiece of sort of tension and release where you don't really give us any clue what you're about to do in book two as you painstakingly set up all these people.
Well, actually, again, I probably look an awful lot cleverer than I actually am. It's the thing is that when I thought, my initial impulse was, I really want to do a really huge book that says all sorts of stuff that at the moment I can't really think what that might be, but I've just got this kind of urge to do something that says everything that I want to say. And I thought, that sounds like it'll probably be quite big. And I started to think about the things I wanted to say. And then I sat down one afternoon with a notebook and a pen, and I thought, right, let's just think of some like really clever sounding titles that will really impress everybody. and yet, which will somehow relate to the sort of things that I want to talk about. And at the end of that, I'd got 35 snappy sounding titles. And then I thought, right, 35. Well, if I did one as a prologue, one as an epilogue, that would leave me 33 that I could just like divide. So I'll try and, all right, this one will do for the prologue, that one will do for the epilogue. Let's try and sort out these other 33 into three piles.
Right.
And then I'll put them into an order. This was all in the same afternoon.
I'm really disappointed to hear this.
Well, and then I just thought, right, now I'll start with the first one then.
Well, yeah.
And then I'll do like the second one. And so on. That is kind, and then you think, and as long as you've left yourself enough room in the structure, then ideas can occur to you.
Yeah.
And I suddenly realised, hey, if the whole second book is about my brother as a kind of three-year-old, yeah, as a ghostly three-year-old running around in space and time with all these dead kids, that will inevitably, it'll read a bit like a kind of hallucinating Enid Blyton, won't it?
That's exactly what it, I mean, it's a hallucinating Enid Blyton, Swallows and Amazons kind of thing, crossed with Dante, Bunyan and William Blake, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. That's exactly
it. Well,
it
is, and it's...
And that who Venn diagram.
You know, sort of, and I didn't know I really wanted to read that until I got it. Well, but it is absolutely that. But also there's a sort of precedent. There's always all those... Inferno has a sort of strange character being taken on a guided journey,
yeah,
of an afterlife. Your afterlife, as I understand it in this, is a heaven built from the dreams and memories of people from Northampton.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a supernatural Northampton. And all the people live in it from all different times simultaneously. The ghosts move through it. And the little boy your brother, during the 10 minutes that he's dead, he has a 350-page adventure where he gets mixed up with devils and they have to get him back to the point where he's revived by the doctor because, yeah, he has some important role to play at, yeah, a later date. But it felt to me like Jack Kirby comics, of visions of unusual worlds, and it felt to me not like this actually. Winsor McKay's Little Nemo.
That is a big influence.
Winsor McKay's Little Nemo in Slumberland, in which a child in pyjamas wanders around a succession of fantastic landscapes.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that the first descriptions of my brother going into this upstairs environment, I was actually thinking consciously of Winsor McKay and thinking about, yeah, he'd have like stars painted everywhere.
Yeah.
And there were all these beautiful design elements. And yeah, that is probably what heaven should look like. And it's gigantic. There's a huge sense of scale in all of Winsor McCay's stuff because he was an architect.
Well, I thought about Crazy Cat as well, the same, which has those odd empty landscapes in it.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know that. Another 1930s. This is a Little Nemo's a 1930s American newspaper
earlier
strip.
Earlier than that, turn of the century.
Turn of the century, that American newspaper strip, where for some reason, sort of the proprietors of these newspapers seem to almost salve their consciences by keeping these surrealist experiments going week after week, like the Crazy Cat landscapes that don't really make sense in normal three-dimensional terms are very much your descriptions of the vast plains of this Northamptonshire afterlife. It got me thinking of those sorts of environments.
I mean, well, probably the only real comic that I think that I refer to or I make much of during the course of the book is Ogden Whitney's Herbie.
From Forbidden Worlds 110.
Forbidden Worlds 110. Yeah. It's sort of, obviously nobody else here has heard of him, but sort of, this is the greatest comic strip character of all time. He was the creation of a guy called Ogden Whitney, who was a chronic alcoholic, but he drew kind of, it was like advertising art.
Well, this is typical of a lot of the areas that you're fascinated with. You don't necessarily see a distinction between a conventionally well thought of artist, a sort of autodidact like William Blake, a working class guy who had visions and worked out through his own sweat how to transfer them to the printed press, and to a sort of a hack like Ogden Whitney, who was drawing 50s and 60s comics in a very, very bland way, and you're probably about to say a way that's so bland that it became sort of surreal, almost.
Yeah.
To you, they're all resources for trying to...
Anything that has got a genuine personal vision behind it, I think that is what is missing from an awful lot of culture.
This thing... Yeah. Well, that, we know you're at the Guardian talk when that's what gets it. That seemed to tie back to your personal, to your own childhood mythology as well, though. You in the third book, there's bits where Alma talks about being in the market in Northampton and getting American comics on Saturday mornings for, and I'm old enough or young enough to remember when American comics weren't in Forbidden Planet. They were ballast for ships that were sent in and distributed almost at random across the weirdest places around the UK. There was no continuity in them, and they seemed like transmissions from another planet. And it seems like this was a really big deal for Alma, for you, to stumble across these things. And particularly that one issue you keep talking about in the book, Forbidden Worlds 110, with this strange strip about the magically powered fat boy.
It's a fat, bespectacled kid who is omnipotent and who, if he meets, like, ghosts, or monsters, or Frankensteins and Draculas, sort of, they, or wild animals, or anything, I think even a comet in one episode, they will all say, it's Herbie Popnecker, and veer away in terror. And I used to identify like mad with him, because he's got these really kind of, these sleepy, bored, indifferent little eyes, and I thought, that I could rock that look.
Yeah.
You know, and he's powered entirely by lollipops, which probably accounts for
as
his obvious obesity. I kind of thought that this is probably, it was apparently how Ogden Whitney looked as a child.
Right.
He'd worked it into the comic strip. I figure that the lollipops are probably booze. That would transport him to different times and different planets.
Yeah, in that book of reprints of that stuff, the editor says that he felt that like the writers tried to come up with things that they thought Ogden Whitney would not be able to draw, that would be beyond him, and because they were interested in the gulf between his abilities and their imagination, and they wanted to kind of exploit that. And I wonder if, at some level, you've sort of done that yourself in this. You've thought, right, you've had the idea to have a world that is 350 pages of a multi-dimensional version of Northampton in which all times are laid over on each other and which all the people from all the history of the town live simultaneously. Then you've sort of punished yourself by having to work out how to describe that.
Yeah, well, it's it was a very self-punishing book, because by the time I got to the end of the second book, I thought, I'm actually kind of getting quite tired.
You didn't do it all in one go, though, in one sitting.
No, but but it was always there, yeah. And I was, and actually, I wasn't doing a lot of other stuff at that time. For the first years of Jerusalem, that was pretty much nearly all I was doing. And when I got to the end of the second book, I thought, I'm absolutely exhausted, but it would be fatal to actually let anybody know that. If that shows in the writing, then the book's screwed.
Yeah.
Because it'll be there forever.
This Guardian podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. To find out more about how to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
Did you find that having read those sort of psychedelic 60s comics as a kid, did you find that where sort of hacks were trying to come up with ways of envisioning these bizarre worlds, did you find that had softened you up in a way when you came across people like Blake or Dante as an adult? I mean, certainly I did. When I first found Blake, I thought, I know what this is. It's the negative zone from the Fantastic Four.
Well, there's a lot of connections there. I mean, I'd say that the comic books back when I started reading them, which was when I was six, seven, what they were tremendous engines of the imagination. It wasn't really even escapism. It was actually enabling kids of 7 or 8 years old to imagine all sorts of things that weren't really discussed in the Beano and the Dandy.
Yeah.
And the point of, you know, comparing like the negative zone from the Fantastic Four with Blake, actually, I would say that Jack Kirby, who, as far as I'm concerned, drew and probably wrote most of the Fantastic Four.
Is this going to be one of these things now where this is on, it goes on the internet and you get loads of death threats?
Yeah, I'll get loads of death threats. Bring them on. But no, the thing is that Jack Kirby was an authentic genius. He was one of the only people working in mainstream comics that I would actually compare to William Blake. Because like William Blake, I mean, William Blake, yeah, he was born to a middle-class family in Golden Square, but then deliberately lived the rest of his life in poverty. Jack Kirby, he was born in Brooklyn. He came up from the kind of the tough turn-of-the-century streets that were sort of, the stuff that was in Gangs of New York.
Yeah.
He was in street gangs when he was a kid, and very much like Blake, he creates all of these gigantic, super-powered figures with slightly wonky names. You know, I mean, like, with Blake, it's the spirit of love. Love is called Luva. Yeah, you know, it's not that good. Whereas in Jack Kirby, the spirit of evil is called Darkseid.
Right.
You know, it's
a toss-up, isn't it?
It is. But they were both saying something gigantic and mythical, and they were both saying that from a background of something impoverished and restricted and probably quite ugly and anything but mythical.
You've made Northampton into a myth, into a metaphor for the idea of an afterlife. Has there been any comeback from people there about that?
Yeah, the Northampton's where you go when you die.
But I mean, it's an amazing thing that you could live in a street in Northampton which now has this incredible fantasy life imposed over it. I mean, Scarletwell Street to me now is in that book all the time. I can't wait to go to Scarletwell Street next time in Northampton. There's a man probably from Northampton laughing at the very idea of that. it's a bit like when you first get to San Francisco and you go, oh, it's the Haight Ashbury. You first get to London when you're a kid and you go, wow, it's all these street names.
Nelson's Cole,
well, that's what Northampton will feel like now.
Most of the people in Northampton seem to be quite tickled
by
it. And also, they seem to think that it's quite realistic, which I think probably says more about the grip upon reality that people in Northampton have more than it does about my book's realism. But it's like, Yeah, I mean, they seem to enjoy it. What was interesting was I had a really nice woman from American National Public Radio who came up to Northampton to interview me. And she came up to the studio where we were doing the interview. And she was saying, on the way up from the station in the cab, I was driving along and I thought, that's Scarlet Wells Street. Yeah, yeah. And yeah, this is a fairly miserable. I mean, the boroughs, if you haven't read the book, I don't think this is a spoiler, but it's hardly there. You know, it's nearly all gone. While, you know, the bit, the garage enclosure that features quite heavily in the third part of the book. Yeah. I was down there with somebody the other day showing them around, and there were excavators just tearing all that down.
As you were there.
As we were watching. It's.
But you, I mean, so in a way, the book's about capturing those little streets of Northampton as you knew them in the 50s, 60s, 70s that are now gone.
Yeah, because that's the only way you can save them.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, I've been down to the place. I know campaigners in the area, and you fight for every little bit, but ultimately it's all going to go.
Yeah.
The only way that you can save it is not in the sense of rescue it, but you can save it like a ship in a bottle, which I think is one of the functions of art, that we do tend to live in a transient world, or at least that's how we perceive it.
The third book shifts gear after the sort of famous five adventure in another dimension, back into, it bounces around between different times again, but it's also about the progress towards the exhibition, Alma's exhibition, that makes sense of all the things we've seen. And we both independently of each other said if you were to read a bit of the book aloud tonight, it would be the start of book three, which seemed the most readable bit. I wonder if you'd mind doing that. He's not read it before.
No, actually, I've been putting it off because it looks a bit difficult.
That woman that writes all Jordan's books wrote it. When the first time he's read it aloud is when he gets to do the audio book. The first time he's read it, he's going, "Who wrote this?"
I didn't actually read the audio book. I'm not going to do that, am I? I mean, that would take years. It's I met the guy who was reading it, Simon Vance, and he was going to do a great job. And he has actually read it all by now.
Right, but aloud.
Allowed.
Yeah, he's read it all.
Yeah,
aloud,
it took him about a month.
How did he get on with the Lucia Joyce chapter? Which
I suggested. He phoned me up and said, "How shall I do this?"
It's hard work, the Lucia Joyce chapter, to be fair.
And all I could say to him was, I suggest a faint Irish accent, and that he should probably go for the musicality of the words rather than their meaning.
I don't know what's funny, the idea of him having to read it or someone listening to it. sort of struggle.
Let's see.
Clouds unfold.
The bits that I can... I think I'll read just the final few paragraphs. This is all narrated by something that turns out to be a stone archangel that is standing on top of the Guildhall in Northampton. He's really there, and he is really, as you can see, holding a snooker cue. Or at least that is what I maintain.
So the fact that the angel looks like it's holding a snooker cue, it's where you got the idea.
No.
There's a strand in the book.
I suddenly thought, wouldn't it be great if you had like the four archangels? They were all playing snooker.
Yeah.
I thought that'd be brilliant. So I got this whole thing that I was building up about the archangels at this giant billiard table that I think is called Trilliards.
Trilliards in your book.
Trilliards. And there's like hundreds and hundreds of balls. And each one is like a human soul, and it's all to do with, I mean, billiards actually became popular in this country after the Civil War, when it provided a brilliant metaphor for Isaac Newton and all of his theories of motion. So I got all of that worked out with these angels playing snooker for human souls, and then I was walking past the Guildhall in Northampton, and I looked up at the Archangel Michael,
yeah,
who I've got as the local billiard champion in Jerusalem. And I thought, what's that he's holding? I thought, that's not a sword, is it? Actually, it's a billiard cue. It's sort of... so this is... This stone archangel knows everything. And he's been going on and on about everything for pages, but we... we get to... I'll read you the first little bit and the last little bit on it, because it opens... It says, always now, and always here, and always me. That's what it's like for you. Now always, and here always, and me always. This is what it's like for me. Now, here, me. Now always, even when it's then. Here always, even when it's there. Me always, even when I'm you. Even when I'm in hell and am I fallen. When am I a thousand fiends? They fold up into you. You fold up into us. We fold up into him. This will be very hard for you. Above space, over history, hovering. Genocide and utopia in the downdraft. Woof. 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 Bull roar of breath through the white feathers sent to conscientious cowards, blood objectors. Woof. 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 Seeing and being everything, never detached and never distant. Pitying you and admiring you, endlessly angry, endlessly in love, Auschwitz and Rembrandt in the upbeat, woomp, woomp, woomp. The view from here is fierce. The view from here is final.
Yeah!
And then the final bit of that, if I've got time, final bit. I am a builder. You'll appreciate that this entails a lot of demolition work. Your world, the way you think about yourselves and your most fundamental notions of reality are the result of unskilled labor, cowboy workmanship. There's bad subsidence. Dry rot in the moral timbers. This will all have to come down, and it's not going to be cheap. Does the phrase clearance area mean anything to you? Ideas of self, ideas of world and family and nation, articles of scientific or religious faith, your creeds and currencies, one by one, the beloved structures falling. Whoop. Whoop. Whoop.
Can we talk a little bit about style, actually, because we've talked a lot about the subject material. And I was trying to work out what I thought of this, and I ended up writing this paragraph. Jerusalem's written in a densely elusive style that lends equal cultural weight to the goth band Bauhaus as to Bunyan's Pilgrim Progress. Every noun and verb is front-loaded with copious adjectives and adverbs and tailgated by extravagant metaphors and similes and new compound words that Alan himself seems to have coined specially for the book, to the extent that the concepts and characters aren't so much clarified by the language used to describe them as exploded like Picasso pictures or remixed in a kind of automatic haze like dub reggae tracks. Style and subject material move between the sacred and the profane, the transcendental and the obscene, the self-consciously clever and the deliberately silly. The reader is misdirected, tricked, presumed upon, and then suddenly massively over-rewarded by the capricious author. And characters and situations that seem random or gratuitous may have a hugely significant payoff 1,000 pages later. And indeed, did I imagine it, or does the same bit of dog's muck with a training shoe footprint in it occur about 4 times in the story, hundreds of pages apart?
Yeah, more than that.
Right,
it's sort of. I saw the bit of dog muck as an essential character.
Oh, right.
I just noticed that I'd had my brother in the prologue walking past a bit of stepped-in dog muck, which he describes in some detail.
Yeah.
At a later chapter, I thought, right, now this is the previous day, so I've got an uncomfortable-looking dog sort of running, and then someone actually sees the dog actually producing the dog muck, and then various other characters see it, and eventually you establish, even the angel in the chapter that I just read, at one point he says, I see the dog turd unbroken on the Friday night,
right,
but broken on the Saturday morning.
Well,
so I make this, it's almost like one of the main points of the book. Who was it who trod in that particular dog turd?
Well, the thing is, though, that one of the great things about it is it's so long that you start to sort of imagine things about it, I think. You kind of live with it all the time. I read a vast amount of it over a 2-week period where I spent 45 minutes a day on hold to Aviva Insurance. Right, so for me, that whole middle section that takes place in a visionary Northamptonshire afterlife is accompanied by the same 3-note electronic tune going round and round. I mean, so the things like the dog, when you start to see these sort of themes, and you can't be sure that you haven't, whether you've remembered it or not, because it's so vast in its, and I mean, the last section, right, seemed to have the same sort of problem that I sometimes get in understanding things about Blake, for example. Book 3 seems to achieve the same kind of cosmic moral relativism that Blake describes, where you don't ascribe a moral value to events. They're all seen from above as a result of these billiard balls knocking together, yeah, and we must sort of accept it. It's that same sort of thing as when Blake says in The Tiger, did he who made the lamb make thee? You ascribe a sort of equal weight and purpose to things as long as they're fulfilling their nature in a way. And yet at the same time, the Alan Moore that advances this idea is very emotionally upset on behalf of the disenfranchised poor or on behalf of victims of sexual assaults. Their pain and their suffering isn't subsumed at the same time into this detached idea. They seem to be in conflict to me in some way.
Perhaps that those particular incidences, I mean, I thought that generally it was better to try and keep as detached a tone as possible for the sake of the entire book, because I could very easily, writing a book like this, I could very easily just completely drown in nostalgia and sentiment. So I was trying to be as objective. This is a very subjective book. So I was trying to be as objective as possible. And probably sometimes when I am particularly upset about something, perhaps that objectivity slips a little bit. But in a sense, that tends to lend those episodes a kind of perhaps hyper-reality. There's suddenly an emotional intensity there that wasn't there before. I think that on the whole, I'm kind of pleased with that effect, you know.
Here's a bit about writing. I'm going to quickly read a paragraph that I think it's not about a hugely significant event, but it's just an interesting thing about style. Mick Warren tosses in slow motion, mindful of his sleeping wife and trying to minimise the mattress creak. The roll onto his left side is a campaign stage in increments, with its objective once accomplished yielding nothing save a differently aligned discomfort. Marinating in his own brine on those sultry slopes of late May, shoulders pummeled by the working week just gone, insomnia reduces his well-trodden consciousness to the schematic mansion of a Cluedo board, thoughts following each other into minimal crime scene conservatories, attempting to establish whereabouts and means and motive. In associative free-fall, he is soon adrift in board games, sleepless mind, advancing square by square, according to delirious and self-inflicted rules of play, a Chinese checker choreography of half-ideas that leapfrog and eliminate each other in their struggle to attain thoughtless oblivion, the pegboard's empty central hole. Cluedo slides lexically into Ludo, Poirot parlours reconfigured as the stylized paths of palace gardens wherein vari-coloured button dynasties conduct their patient courtly intrigues. Ludo. Mick thinks he can distantly remember his big sister telling him the term had some kind of significance, but for the moment it eludes him. Words and wordplay aren't his speciality, and thus he is averse to Scrabble, name alone too reminiscent to his frantic rat-like mental processes when trying to extract coherent language from an angular furniture sale of consonants or from an ululating funeral lament of vowels. Now, to convey that, Dan Brown would have written, Mick rolled over in bed.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so long. What I did find reading it again, it had a fantastic effect that From Hell had on me 20 years ago, where the imagery and language is so vivid that it changes the world around you, and you start to notice, you feel more alive whilst reading it. And actually, when I finished it, I had a terrible sort of sense of loss that the world around me wasn't going to be vivid in the way that it had been for the period that I was reading the book, because you start to find yourself thinking in those terms where your very actions and sounds you hear have extra meaning or extra adjectives attached to them, because you start thinking like you would think, which you can't avoid because you have to live with it for such a long time.
That's brilliant. I'm really glad that you felt. I mean, look, I remember reading Patrick Susskind's book, Perfume.
Yeah.
And you find, I mean, my sense of smell is pretty much non-existent most of the time, you know, but after reading a book like that, you suddenly find that you are consciously noticing all these different kind of shades of a perfume or an odour. Yeah, I think that actually just reading words about stuff can actually rewire you.
If you take one thing away from this Guardian Literary
reading
podcast...
Reading words about stuff.
It's the sense... There can be no broader encouragement for the notion of reading in its widest sense than just words about stuff. Is worth it. The bar has been lowered spectacularly. Did it has it helped you in any way or changed your relationship with your family to spend so many words thinking about how to mythologize them and how to use them as symbols for a nation and symbols for a people and as ways of exploring time? I mean, they've had all this stuff loaded on them. Many of them are still alive, the people you write about, and they're now become semi-fictionalised characters in this work.
Yeah, they've more or less completely disowned me, Stuart. No, I mean, like, the only major members of my family that are alive, my brother, who somehow managed to mess up actually terminating his existence at the age of five, you know, he's actually reading Jerusalem. He's probably near enough finished it. And, you know, frankly, he wasn't the most literate brother, you know. And I was knocked out. He's really enjoying it. And a lot of the people who've read it, who do know me and know my circumstances, have also said that they enjoy it. And also that they think it is fairly true to life, which is just ridiculous because I've made it all up, you know. But at least, in the case of my brother, that 10 minutes of oxygen starvation when he was a lot younger, that may explain a lot, you know, that he's quite credulous, to be honest.
Was it a conscious decision at this point in the culture where everything's going virtual and we're being told the novel's dead and no one will listen to an album all the way through, to produce such a significant physical object at this point?
Yeah.
You know, it's almost a provocative thing to do, and I admire you for it.
I think that there's always been a certain amount of perversity with everything that I do, because I really like things that are completely wretched and despised, because that gives you much more room. Nobody cares. You know, like with comics, when I started out in the comics field, nobody cared about comics. They were completely unknown. It was the sort of the most wretched job in the world. You were never going to sort of get any attention from doing comics.
And you're saying the same is now true of literary fiction?
Literary fiction. I mean, I went through comics.
So you've moved into it.
Then
in its death throes.
Me and Melinda, we did Lost Girls because I was thinking, yeah, pornography.
Yeah.
Pornography is completely despised. Nobody's doing anything with it. So we did that. Then I thought, yeah, magic. Everybody thinks you're mad if you do something about magic. That is the easiest way to alienate everybody. Yeah. So after, yeah, comics, pornography and magic, I thought literary fiction is, you know, it's the next obvious target, really, isn't it?
Should we clap that sentence? Because it's a good...
Alan Moore's Jerusalem is published by LiveWrite and is out right now. And that's all for this week. Next week, join us as we discuss fairy tales and more myth-making with Margaret Drabble and the Ruby Dolls. After the tough year we've had, we'll ask, do we believe in happily ever afters? For more literary interviews, discussions and live events, just search for Guardian Books Podcast. You can find us at theguardian.com, on iTunes, on SoundCloud or on your smartphone. Just look for us via your favourite podcast app. But for now, from me, Claire Armitstead, and my producer, Susanna Trezillian, thanks for listening and goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.